In the late 1800s and early 1900s, scores of Armenians fled their homeland to escape the systematic persecution and slaughter of their people waged by the Ottoman Empire. In 1914, Armine Alshian was born in a community of displaced Armenians that relocated in Fresno, California. This community in Fresno was very close-knit and was characterized by a sense of family and supportiveness.
That was a big advantage because the parents would sort of steer their children. You're always living with the rest of the big other clan group. And your parents would steer you into, you'd be playing with them all the time. You know, you're always visiting them. It had a lot of advantage, a lot of nice features. You know? You were never a loss for friends or help. If you were in trouble, someone would help.
As a young man, Alshian studied at Fresno State College before earning his degree at Stanford. He continued at Stanford, earning his Ph.D. in economics in 1943. His entire teaching career was spent at UCLA with extensive consulting at the Rand Corporation. Through a number of essential and very influential articles, as well as his work in the classroom, Alshian has become recognized as one of the most influential voices in the areas of property rights, the theory of the firm, the relation of cost to production, law and economics, unemployment and the effects of inflation. His critique of the Keynes theory of investment in 1955 served as a cornerstone work in modern investment theory. Countless undergraduate and graduate students have studied his textbook, Exchange and Production, written with William Allen. And he has provided counsel and guidance for generations of graduate students at UCLA. Alshian has distinguished himself by an uncanny ability to clarify difficult issues and view economics in new and revealing ways. Throughout his scholarly and teaching work, Armin Alshian has always paid particular attention to the critical role of actions of individuals, rather than groups, within economic systems. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Professor Armin Alshian.
What drove your grandparents on one side and your father on the other side to come to America?
Well, the same thing. My mother's family and my father's family both came from roughly the same area in Armenia, Erzurum area, it's called. And my mother was then at that time called a Yanikian or an Ormart, because when the first Yanikian came to the United States, he said, "I'm a new man." And Armenian, nor is new and mart is man. So he took down the word new man. So you go and you say you're Normart means you're a new man. That was my mother's family. They grew up in two little towns, not more than a few miles apart. They knew each other. Those Armenians are clannish. There's a big clan.
Was it political forces that drove them to America, or freedom?
Well, it was the Christian and the Turkish persecution. They used persecution. The Turks themselves, the people were very, very kind. During these big drives when they drove Armenians out of that eastern part of Turkey, the Turkish people were very kind to these poor guys struggling across the country. I would read stories about some of the survivors who would tell how these Turkish families would help these poor guys while the Turkish troops were goading them on. So the Turkish major government of Turkey was the one driving them out.
Was this a regular topic of conversation when you were growing up? I mean, did the persecution that your immediate ancestors had suffered, did that play a role in how your thinking developed?
Yeah, it played a role in your culture at home. The Armenians were very, very clannish, and it continued on to the 1917s in the wartime. There was still continued on. There were big charity drives, so when I was up at the time, I was to the 1920s, 25s, the Armenian community in Fresno would do quite a lot, raising charity money to ship over to Armenia to bring more people out, and they did that, and that was part of our culture that you had to do this.
Was your father in business in the private sector?
He got a job first day in a assistant to a tailor. And then after about a few months or a year, went into pawn shop business and then became a jeweler and successfully out of life. Worked out well. But they all worked. It was, in those days, there were no unemployed. There were bums. Or they worked. And the Clannish family had a big advantage. You knew who the bums were.
You grew up during the Great Depression, and for many people who grew up...
I grew up before then. Dude, I was...
Well, you were, what, 14, 15, 16 when
I
started?
I was 16 years old in 1930. Okay. Yeah, I was grown. I was a grown man at 16. Yeah,
but,
I did.
But many people who were roughly that vintage, the Depression had a profound effect on their view of the world, their attitude toward the market, mm-hmm. their attitude toward government. Did it have any particularly lasting effect on you?
I suppose so. I can't identify what effect it had, but it certainly... at that time, my adult friends, the ones who were, say, 20, 25, 30, young fellows I talked to, were anti-Roosevelt, very much so. They were very afraid about freedoms, strangely enough, I look back. And they kept saying, he's ruining the country, and I grew up with a lot of those people. And I was the opposite. You know, a young kid always, you know, I've nationalized the banks. Why? Well, I don't know why, but, you know, young, that's what my professor said at State. So most of the older people I associated with were either quiet on the subject or really antagonistic to them. I can now, as I look back, understand why. In fact, when I got to Stanford in 32, 34, 36, the department almost to a man was objecting to his policies about really restraining the recovery. It was. It really restrained the recovery. Because in the 34 to 36, it was clear there was a lot of discussion. Why is he doing these crazy things that are reducing incentive to recover? Price controls and regulations and your tax on business are phenomenal. You have to live through that, I think, to realize how businessmen, particularly Wall Street, were the devils of this world. It was just amazing, awful. It taught you, it didn't teach you. It created a suspicion of what government was doing, that they didn't always know what the best thing was for you. This was so adamantly expressed so often.
You started your college at Fresno State, which I guess must have been a very small school, and then transferred to Stanford.
Yeah.
Did you start at Fresno State for financial reasons?
I had admitted to Stanford as soon as I got out of high school in February, and we applied, and I got back right away. You're accepted, you're admitted, and went up there in the summer because it looked like I was going to be able to finance it. I went up and talked to the dean about it, and we discussed it. He was very nice about it. An hour we talked, pros and cons, and he finally said, well, I think your best bet would be, I got in a fellowship for about $200, which is a good amount, and paid the first quarter tuition. He said, and he was sympathetic. He said, we're having a lot of trouble like that, and he said, it might be best if you were to stay in your local state college, Goodson College, Fresno State, until things get better and then come back. We'll always accept you. You got a permanent invitation. Don't worry about it. So I went back. I cried. It's terrible. And I went to Fresno State. And it was a good experience. I had a good teacher there, better teacher than at Stanford. They really were teaching you well. So I don't regret that at all. But I do regret the inability to go. That was really heartbreaking. Even now it makes me cry in a way. And then 2 years, I went to Stanford, and I was only at Stanford 2 years.
Some of your professors at Stanford at that time turned out to be quite famous.
Yeah.
I mean, can I reel off a couple of names and ask you to tell me what sort of impact they may have had on you? Mm-hmm. Alan Wallace, who went on to become the president of the University of Rochester and Undersecretary of State.
Leo Harris, whom I just mentioned, and the football coach, and Alan Wallace, the two non-relatives who are the big heroes of my life. He came in 37. I think it was 37. I didn't know who he was. Some new guy teaching statistics. And I took his class in statistics, three of us. And he gave us the modern new statistics. It was an eye-opener. It was a great probability theory. He gave us R.A. Fisher's biological methods. It's hard as hell to read. About the famous lady tasting tea, whether you put cream in or put sugar first, can you tell? The lady claimed she could tell when you gave her a cup of tea whether you put the cream in first or whether you put the sugar in first. And their problem was to test her ability to do that. How would you design the experiment? That was his first thing. And it was a good problem. design experiment, the testing of the hypothesis, all done. And that was the new statistics. And look, here it was. It had just been out right at the beginning of the time. And so I was taking Alan Wolfson's course, and he would ask me, well, what are they teaching over in economics? Same department. And I'd tell him, he said, what do they teach about price controls? I said, nothing. Rolled his eyes, you know.
For some economists, and I'm sure other disciplines too, their dissertations are real sort of staging grounds for later success. In fact, sometimes they're arguably their best work. Was that true of your dissertation?
This is my worst work. I was saved. I started it in 1940, and the war came and I couldn't work on it. And it gave me a good excuse to get by with these. So I wrote, finished it up and gave it in as wartime. You know, it's a war, signed dissertation, out you go. So the war enabled me to literally cheat on dissertation. You could get by the cheap one, and which is probably as good as not.
What is it that you're working on now that's more important to you than an extra round of golf every day?
Well, not much more important than just being able to get out and play around the golf indicates something about the state of your health, that you can go out, and that's sort of reassuring, because there are some times when you just can't do it, your back gives out, and that does make you feel old. But when you get out there, especially in the morning, with the sun coming up, it's really beautiful, you feel good. And that's the joy of playing golf. It's not the afternoon sweating around trying to sink the ball every time. It's just being out there. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
But then if you come in off the course, though, you're sitting down at a computer, and you're still
writing.
Yeah.
Well, then when that off the course, it's I guess now the principal interest is writing the textbook, a chance to say what I think is useful economics for an ordinary person, in particular my daughter and son, who were. My son wanted to know, what the hell you taught? You know, what is it you're getting all this money for? What do you do? So I said, oh, you use the textbook for that. And then my daughter, who has economics, got her PhD, I thought she ought to be better. And so I was writing that. But not first. When I first started to revise it, I thought I'd revise it because it would be a useful book. But as it dragged on for years, I thought, why in the hell am I doing this? And I said, oh, for my daughter. She'll learn economics better than she now knows it. And I think she has, because she's read every sentence over and over and tried to improve it and tell me what should not be there and what she'd like to have. And so in that sense, I've been motivated by teaching my own family about this material.
Your first paper, your first sort of full-length paper, was called Uncertainty, Evolution, and Economic Theory.
Yeah, good paper. Good paper.
Must have been pretty good. It's still generating citations.
Yeah, it was. As I read it not long ago, I thought, I can't write that way anymore. I didn't write that, did I? I really didn't. And that same impression, Jacques Hirschleiber, who's very, very good, written a lot of early works, he says the same things. I read my earlier papers, he says, and I can't believe I wrote that stuff.
So the debate at this time had been, do businessmen really maximize profits?
Yeah, do they really sit down and, well, or do they really use marginal cost, marginal revenue concepts? Are they really maximizing, are they trying to maximize profits?
And so what was the key idea in your paper, in this one?
It doesn't make a damn difference what they're trying to do. You know, if they don't get close to that, they aren't going to survive. So what a guy tries to do is less important than what the survival tests are. You know, if you try to get tall, you can't get taller, but if you aren't tall, you aren't going to survive. I don't give a damn what your incentives are. It's what you do, no matter why you did it. That's what's been the pervasive point. I didn't realize until in the 50s, 60s, after this paper, how much evolutionary theory had fallen out of the mainstream of analysis. Because in the late 50s, I think, there was a conference in Chicago which almost revived evolution as an inherent part of our analysis. I don't know whether you knew about this or not, but there was this thing, and I was taken aback that as if between the 1920s and 1950s, it had just been ignored in the way we think about events in the social sciences.
Well, there's a line in that paper that I every once in a while use to my students to take them aback, and the line is, even in a world of stupid men, they would still be prophets.
I wanted to take out the even. In a world of, yeah.
This paper was published in the Journal of Political Economy, yeah. And Milton Friedman at that time involved with the JPE? Did he have any role
yes.
in the acceptance of this paper?
Somehow, I can't recall now, he saw the paper before it was published and wrote back to me a very encouraging letter saying, yes, we'll publish it. I think it's what it said, yes, we'll publish it. Just make a few of these little corrections.
I guess shortly before and after this time, in addition to worrying about mm-hmm. This problem, we're also thinking about the relationship between production and costs. And in fact, you ended up publishing several papers yeah. on this topic. When did you start working first on the link yeah. between production and costs?
That came after I started working at RAND. At RAND, we began to look at the cost of producing different kind of engines and parts. I started to work on the measurements of cost because they're costing airplanes. And, I'd go look at the literature, and I couldn't quite understand what they were talking about. I'll explain why in a moment. And what I can say now as I look back at it was that we had just used the diagram and put on a horizontal axis, 1, 2, 3 output, and never thought about what the dimension of that output was, whether it was volume or rate or speed or whatnot. But in looking at a real problem and trying to give a sensible answer, I began to realize we had to understand more fully. I looked at the engineering literature on costs, and we're getting results. We're getting statements completely contrary, not completely, but contrary to economic principles. They had falling marginal costs. They literally called them falling marginal costs. Now, any economist knows that marginal costs always are rising. They don't fall. But here were engineers, not only were they falling, they were falling at 20% every time you double the output, called the 80% curve. I went into Charlie Hitch, and I said, Hitch, look at this data. Look at what we do. He said, that's interesting. I said, well, something is wrong. I don't know what it was in looking at that one day. All of a sudden, it hit me. Oh, these numbers are the number of planes you have produced.
So they were measuring the total volume of production.
They were measuring what I now call volume. This is the 10th plane, the 20th plane. So if you're going to make 40 planes, you can make 40 planes at a lower cost per plane than you can if you make just 10 planes. I know that. But if you look at the economics textbook, there isn't one textbook. Well, there wasn't one textbook, but now there's one. That on the horizontal axis points out you can have different dimensions. It can be the speed of output, the total volume, at least those two. And the costs vary with these two in very different ways. Well, that I learned by having to look at cost of airplanes. And I thought it was kind of important, so I began to write it up. What it also did was make clear that you've got to talk about capital values. Not about the current rate of cost. And that was even more important, I thought. So I wrote this paper called Costs and Outputs, which emphasized capital value measure the cost and the volume effect.
You've said I'll tell you the article, you've said economics is a study of property rights.
Yeah. You know, that would make sense if you look at economics as a study of how markets work. And in markets, you trade rights back and forth rather than goods. And that makes a big difference to emphasize you're trading rights to goods rather than goods. You'll think that's a very important distinction, but it's a crucial distinction for making the student understand what you're trading and that not only is the good itself worthwhile, but what are the rights I have to it? And that bit about what rights I have to it, this has been slighted a lot in most of the textbooks.
In that same connection, you distinguish between some elements of property rights, and one of those is the domain of activities or uses.
There was a book I was at RAND and with Bill Meckling, whom I learned a lot, and. We were worrying about how the RAND was organized and the problems you had in getting people in the engineering department to come in and work in the economics department for a week or two because they had to work over there. And if he worked with you, how could he get credit for his work over there? So we thought, well, why don't we give him points or why don't we give him some kind of credit? So we sat around for, I guess, a week or trying to figure out different systems. Every one of them broke down. So I luckily ran across one of the greatest books I've ever read. I'd rank it next to Adam Smith. It's called History of English Law from the Time of Edward II, and by Pollock and Maitland, whose first names I don't know. It is a phenomenal book, and you probably have never read it, but I have read it twice. I'm reading it again, because every time I read it, I see more things in there, because it's the story of the development of the law of England, which is our law. But it's also the study of the development of our customs and our behavior and our rights and our political system. It's a phenomenal book. I'm really, set aside this interview, I'll tell you, look at it. It's just great. And so I got very intrigued by this, the structure of property rights we're developing, because he contrasts with the French and the Roman law, which did not develop in England, and why it didn't. So I thought, gee, I'm going to look some more at this. I started working on this property rights stuff and writing up what I thought I understood, and it was fun. That's how it started. It was a little conversation, that little event.
It seems to me that transferability of property rights has always been an essential part of the study of those rights. I mean, is that like a critical distinction, for example, between private property and public property?
Yeah, there's a fellow named Cliff Holderness, who will be coming to this conference we're going to be having later in the week, who has written two good papers on the transferability of a right to, say, that chair. If you and I, quote, own that chair, you and I, we got a problem of deciding whether we're going to sell or not and how we're going to split up any proceeds. We got another problem if he walks along and joins us, sits down, and now does he acquire rights to it by virtue of having come in the room and sat down with us? Is the set of, quote, owners open or closed? And he says, unless the set is closed, the idea of property rights becomes very vague, because you don't know what they are, because everybody in the world can come in and join you. And so, it's like going into a city. The city says, you now own this, you're now an owner of this auditorium in this city. And I said, well, let me tell you a story. We were up at Shasta Dam up in Northern California with Bill Meckling, and a big dam there, and the guide said, and you all own this dam, it's public property. Bill said, I'll sell my share for 10 cents. Well, the guide was very upset about that. But I said, Bill, that's right. What the hell does it mean you own this thing? What are you? Well, that's the time everything was this ownership stuff. Holderness has this good paper on trying to define what he means by a closed set of owners, as distinct from an open set. Where an open set, you can be joined, like a symphony orchestra. They say, oh, come on and be part of an orchestra. Now, what a closed set isn't quite clear enough, defined yet. I think he means by it, and as I read it, that to come in, you've got to buy your way in. You've got to pay something to the rest of us. And he talks that way. That the distinction of what defines closure is still a little vague. But if you talk about having the idea of private property rights and say that we have private property rights which we're going to share, no one else can join without our permission. Now, in a corporation, it's a privately owned thing. We have several owners. But a third party can come in without our permission. But he has to buy his way in. Mm-hmm. He's got to buy his rights from one of us. And that, I think, is closure, as he puts it. If you've got that kind of limitation on the class of owners, you've got what could be, or what I'll say is, or what he says is private property rights. Without that closure, you've got something undefined. You've got some other class. And to call both of these as ownership is very misleading and very dangerous. But that is a weak point, I think, in most of the literature I've read in the law journals and elsewhere about what do you mean by property rights. I'm convinced the Supreme Court doesn't understand that. If you've got private property rights, you don't have to talk about free speech. I mean, maybe be evasive to get around the point. I don't know how other people define it. I read the Constitution. It doesn't define it. It just says the rights of speech shall not be abridged. Well, if I define free speech as what I think it means, that you and I can voluntarily talk to each other, voluntarily. I can come in and say, Ben, would you like to talk to me about a topic? You say, yes, I can do it. It does not include my right to come to you and say, Ben, listen to me. I want to talk to you and tell you something. You want to hear me or not? You listen to me. That's not free speech. It's got to be free in the sense that you willingly listen to it and I willingly tell it to you. Once you accept that, there are no more problems, because if you talk about the guy on the sidewalk shouting with his horn to me in the house, I didn't want to hear that. That isn't free speech. They confuse free speech with free resources, as if these resources, including me, are free for their taking. Well, the court believes that. You read the recent decision of the court, they believe that you have the right to take that guy's property in order to make him hear what you're talking about. That's called free speech.
A Nobel laureate, Bill Sharp, actually described your classes as being like a big wrestling match.
Well, it was. It was intended to be whatever you said that was getting close to the answer, I'd try to push away from to see if you would stubbornly know what you had that you wanted to push the point. So quite often, the more I said no to students, the word got around, they said, well, the better you are if he's pushing you around. I just thought it was a good way to learn the stuff, because you got to use the economics. You don't just repeat the words. You got to be able to apply it.
What is, you think, the role or roles of a teacher? What roles did you try and perform in the classroom?
I know my general principle is good or not, is to expose them to the idea and make them repeat it to you. My general principle, if you can't say it, you don't know it. Now, right or wrong, and so I'd go into class and ask these questions, and they get these answers, and I'd say, yeah, until you say it once or twice, I just think you really don't know it, or until you write it out. And students don't do that on their own.
You also did something else. In the graduate price theory sequence, we probably did not talk about 90% of what's conventionally covered in price theory. But the other 10%...
You learned harder.
We learned that very well. I always felt like that was a systematic attempt on your part. Teach narrow, but teach deep.
Elmer Fagan, back at Stanford, said, don't teach too much. Teach a little bit. If they learn to learn how to learn economics and use it, they'll do it the rest of themselves if they want. That was the great. And I just said, I'm going to teach a little bit. I'm not trying to cover everything. What we teach, we're going to cover well. And then you go out and apply that.
Most people think of you as a price theorist, a microeconomist. But you've done at least one strand of work that most people would consider to be rather macro-oriented. Mm-hmm. And that's the work you did with Reuben Kessel on inflation. How did you two get started working on inflation?
He came to Rand. There was McLean, Kessel. No matter, the whole group. He came to Rand. I was a consultant all the time at Rand, never a staff member in that sense. So I had an office where uncleared personnel who were first hired would come and wait for 6 months until they got clearance to go into the so-called secret stuff, which is no more secret than anything else. In came Reuben Kessel one day. Reuben's a hard-nosed guy, very hard-nosed, and no romance about the world. He understood what motives were. And so we sat there talking at great length, and he was sort of fresh air in a way. He was a guy who was street educated, put it that way, and would say things to you that he understands economics. He'd say to the stock market, I'll give you three to two, and you bet on the stock, and I'll bet you against you. You're just worse than the market. And he would do that to friends, and he had a good sense in doing it. I think Reuben and I knew more about inflation than anybody else around. We read all the articles, and most of them were just screwy, just plain crazy. And we wrote articles pointing that out, and some of them were very good articles.
Kessel were really the first to emphasize the importance of the distinction between unanticipated and anticipated inflation, weren't you?
We were the first, I guess, to heavily emphasize it. But Jim Buchanan had mentioned it once to me earlier, too. That wasn't what we thought we designed. That was straightforward. It was just that Reuben hadn't emphasized that point. But it was, the interest rate hadn't anticipated inflation. That's the way you're putting it. And you could think of interest rate not anticipating, or whether that's anticipated if it has. So whether you talk of interest rates or anticipation make any difference. Reuben talked about interest rates. Buchanan mentioned anticipation. It was around. It was just a matter of getting the data, establishing it, and looking at other episodes to see what had happened. That's what the fun was, looking at the Civil War, the Spanish one, and other episodes, the German episode, to see what happened. And some of them is just so obvious.
But people today, when they talk about the effects of inflation, are really sloppy. My impression is they're sloppy. And they fail to distinguish. Are you talking about a change in anticipated inflation or a change in unanticipated inflation?
There's an enormous amount of junk out there. There is. We got it right. There's a lot of junk out there. There is an interesting problem on that whole field that Ben Klein and I wrote about. You can raise a question and still not know what the hell the answer is. We argue that you should take into account asset prices. They only take into account things like price of buying food, consumption items. What about the price of houses, the price of land, the price of stocks? There's pretty wide agreement now. Yeah, we ought to do that. But how?
It's commonplace, I think, for people to argue that during inflation, and I'll leave it at that, wages lag behind prices. Yeah.
Well, that was essentially Hamilton's thesis, and the businessmen made profits.
Yeah.
And Keynes said the same thing in his, no, he didn't. In his first paper, the treatise, but the one on the Indian currency, there was one way back then.
Indian currency reform? Was it that book?
I think it was. He had it right. But on his treatise, he had it wrong. It was amazing. I just flipped around. The businessmen made profits before he said they didn't, and he had it right. Of course, there is also the other problem that during inflation, you got you don't know what relative prices are going to be, and so there's relative price changes that you're not aware of, and that distorts what happens, but that's a separate feature. So that we weren't looking at the effects of inflation in general, we were looking at the effects of inflation on transfers of wealth from one class to another class. And it's from debtors to creditors if the inflation has not been anticipated. If it has been anticipated, there's no transfers. What there is distortions of production of various goods.
A friend of ours who lives in Israel.
He'll know.
This is actually a she, and she talked about inflation in Israel, where it has routinely run at 20% plus. And she says that a significant part-time job for her is shopping.
Yeah.
Because she says, she has no training in economics, but she says. Yeah. During inflation, high periods of high inflation, relative price changes become more frequent and become larger. And so she spends a lot of her time just looking for relative price changes.
That is one of the points that there's something that's good to be able to talk about. Is there a greater variance of relative prices during inflation? And all of your theory would say, yes, there would be. I've never seen any good data, but there's a lot of this story, which I think is meaningful, personal experience. They just find the relative prices go up and down, and you don't know what's going on. You don't know whether the price is high or low. You got to spend time shopping and looking, because they're adjusting all the time, lags and leads. That is definitely, according to all the information that I've seen, a serious problem of inflation. Okay. That's why inflation tends to reduce the rate of growth rather than increase it.
You once told me that you considered one of your papers your best and hardest.
Let's see if I can tell which one it was now.
Exactly.
The one with on the information costs. Yeah. That's a good paper. I keep saying all my papers. There's some we won't talk about. We had Milton Friedman and Rose over one night for dinner, and I raised a question with Milton. You keep saying wages are sticky or something like this. That's not an answer. That doesn't work.
Now, the question you raised was, why is there unemployment?
Yeah. You just keep saying they're sticky, but that's not an answer. It doesn't explain anything. And he said, yes, it does. Yes. And then Rose said, come on, Milton, you know it doesn't. You know very well it doesn't. She's very good. And he said, yeah. I said, we just don't have an explanation of why that this happens. And so that started thinking long and hard about it. I was out playing golf, comes in handy with George Stigler, and we were walking down this fairway. I remember it well. I think it was at Rancho, and I raised the matter. He said, well, have you ever thought about the cost of information? And I don't know why, but at that point, the lights went off. And I said, oh, my God. yeah, that's a good idea. And then I went back and started to work on this paper. And I guess, I don't know, a year or whatever it was, went on. And I even developed a theory of option pricing in there. There's a little footnote that has the Black-Scholes option pricing model in there. It's right there. I'm telling you, it looked so long. It's the simple rule. When the cost of one more search exceeds the expected gain for one more search, you stop. But to put that in a mathematical form and other stuff, it's tricky. So it's in there. But once you get that idea, a whole class of behavior opened up. And from that point on, everything I do now is, you know, everything we all do is a search theory. To show you how, this is a digression, but it's fun, how much that idea appeals to people when you teach it to them. I was teaching the federal judges, and I've been going to that class. After I did this in my classroom, this worked. I said, well, you got out of law school, you got some offers, didn't you? They all come the same instant. How did you decide which one to accept? You looked at what you had, and you said, well, this is the one I got, the best one. But why didn't you look another 6 months? You know, I don't want to say you're dumb, but why didn't you look 6 months more longer? What was the matter with you? You didn't get the best job available. You know, they got the point. And once they understand this, that there is this search, and you never get really a perfection, and you use this economic principle, and then you apply it. You say, now, how can we verify or apply that? Well, you can explain unemployment that way, and that's how that search thing got in there. Now, of course, today, it wasn't new with me. I know I was one of the ones to use it. It's now the modern theory of pricing and searching.
Well, you know, information plays is the central to that article, but yeah. That got me thinking about Hayek's piece, yeah, in some sense unrelated, but the piece on the use of knowledge, mm-hmm, in society. Yeah. And in that paper, he makes the point that prices convey an enormous amount of, yeah, information, and, mm-hmm, for that reason, markets which use prices have a tremendous advantage over other means of allocating resources. Now, given that fact, why do we see firms, which I think you, yeah, think in some sense are an attempt to subvert the market?
This sounds like setting up a dead deer in front of a lion and say, what is that? The lion knows damn well, boy, I really like that. You know, it's a setup in a way. Well, it is for me, because as you well know, that while I thought Coase's work on the theory of the firm was great when it first came out, I think it's just dead wrong. This is only a trivial part of Coase's work. He could reject all this from his record, he'd still be tremendous. You know? So it's not an attack on his work, it's an attack on one little issue, and that is his reference to transactions costs as the reason for the firm. And one way to get at that is say, well, why do people get married? To reduce transactions costs. That's what he'd have to say, because a marriage is a firm. So if you put it that way, you're saying, well, you aren't telling me much about what the marriage is. You're telling me that if you get married, you reduce some transactions costs. But why in the world should I get married in the first place? Why should I form a firm? Not just to reduce transaction costs. That's not why I form. That's what I would argue, and I'm now on tentative grounds here. I don't say it with nearly the assurance I would about the inflation, but I'm convinced, and I could be dead wrong, and a few others independently are also convinced of this. Now, my co-author, Harold Demsetz, is not convinced of it. I don't know why. He's been resistant to the idea, although we talked about it together earlier, and it's in the article that we wrote, which says a firm is able to produce more than the sum of the two independent, physically productive resources. It's more productive, not in the sense in which it specialization. If specialization merely avoids higher marginal costs. You don't do what's more expensive to do. I do what's cheaper for me to do. We don't raise our productive possibility. I can't do any more than I did before. You can't do any more than you did before. We just don't waste time. But when you get these, when you go swarm a firm, the allegation is, we join to do something different that we couldn't possibly do we just produce more. We're what they call it super productive. The total production potential increases. So this, God gave us a miracle. And I said, yeah, you get married. Why? To produce that child. Now, you can't do that by transactions cost reduction. That's not specialization. We call it teamwork. What the hell teamwork is, I don't know. Anyway, that's a rough idea.
But then you have an entirely different paper on firms that doesn't rely on teamwork at all. Your work with Ben Klein and Bob Crawford vertical integration.
Yeah. What Harold and I did not emphasize in the teamwork in the first paper was the dependency among two people. We had this teamwork, but we didn't talk about how you got to keep him tied to you so he can't exploit you by saying, if I go away, you're going to lose a lot of money. We ignored that, as I recall, we ignored that problem. Never thought about it. It wasn't later until I was working, I guess it was later, with Bob Crawford, who'd come to UCLA to spend some time there just studying. And we thought we were working on the problem of so-called integration, vertical integration at that time. And in the course of that, somehow, I don't know how, this idea that there is this dependency such that if I walk away, you're going to lose a hell of a lot. And I may try to extract that from you as a price of not walking away. Marriage is a great case. The woman's not going to leave unless you give me a new car. Well, at that point, we began to put this in as a feature in the paper on integration. But he was working on vertical integration. That's what he wanted to work on. So this understanding came in that context. So we put it in the context of vertical integration, which is a great mistake. It should have been in the context of any teamwork. But when two firms integrate, that immediately raised the problem about the dependency. So we concentrated on that. And that became, in a sense, the major theme of the paper. But the best paper was one with Susan Woodward. Now, Susan Woodward...
This was the paper where you reviewed Oliver Williamson's book?
Yeah.
Susan, why was that paper so good?
Because it's good. Because Susan worked on it. Well, there came out this review. I was asked to do a review of Williamson's book. And I said, Susan, Susan got this request. If you'll do it with me, I'll do it. Otherwise, I'm not going to bother. I think we might be able to straighten Williamson out. And she said, of course. And we wrote it together. And it's a good paper.
And it really does clearly emphasize that there are two motives for the firm.
Yeah, I think it does, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Williamson had it right. You know, he's got it in the sense of the outline about this conflict. And he ends up saying the trick is to make the contract in such a way that you'll be exempt from that, or you protect yourself from that ahead of time. That's right. But we tried to go in a little more detail about the issue in a broader sense. Which firms will have this problem? Which ones won't have it? Where do you not see it? Where do you don't see it? Why do some firms have all stock? Why do have some all bond financing? Because you can explain a lot of the financial structure of a firm, simple case, stock versus bonds, by that issue. A research firm will never have all bonds. They'll clean you out. Public utilities, where there's not much chance to, they'll have all bonds. If you think about it, you'll see the issue. Well, this paper sort of does that, applies to financial structures, and now that's being done in finance.
Let me turn for a moment to your work on textbook. You and Bill Allen wrote University Economics together.
This one.
You're now working on a sequel, which has the title?
Universal Economics. That's a great name. The editor of Oxford Press said, I like that name. I said, it is universal. Except it's private property, but it's universal. But the principles, I said, universal. They're just applied to the private property structure. You know.
Well, what impact do you think working on a textbook had on the acceptance or the dissemination of your ideas? And by that I mean, it seems to me there's a trade-off. If you work on a text, you can perhaps hit a wider audience, but still there's an opportunity cost. You could have written more papers.
Yes. I'm sure the textbook had some influence because at that time I had a lot of graduate students, and a lot of them adopted the textbook. How many of the books were adopted by non-graduate students, but I don't, maybe none. But it did have influence in whom they taught. And I now get letters from people who said they studied that textbook. And some of them are really, really make you jump for joy, you know, I think somebody. So I think it had more influence to students, ordinary students, than the articles, you know, they don't care. But the textbook apparently did have some influence. At least I hope it did.
It's always seemed to me that in all of your work, the unit of analysis is the individual. There's no talk about, well, the group did this or the organization did this. It's always focused on incentives at the individual level and choice at the individual level. How did you come about sort of adopting that as your approach to economics?
And how did I get to that individual?
Yes.
I don't know. Undoubtedly, your colleagues did it. Jack Hirschleiber, who was heavy in sociobiology, and we were trying to analyze economic analysis, the theory and the foundations, and you got to get down to some unit. And we had the individual as the unit rather than groups. And that's what we did. Then, before long, again with Jack, we were sharing an office at Rand, and we would chat about anything we want to talk about. He said, what about the gene? We just read Dawkins' book on the selfish gene, which a very impressive book to me. And I thought, and he is the one who says you should look at the gene level. I thought, yeah, you should. But there wasn't much in economics that would let you do that, since genes weren't presumed to be making choices. But I deliberately, after learning more about the new sociobiology and the genetic structure, to look at the gene. Anyway, I do think that our economics would be improved, and it would broaden if we thought more about the gene structure. Not in these terms about racial differences, that's trivial, but more in terms about our behavior, how I will do things in a society, like you fall down. I give this to my class. I don't know why I'm telling you this. You fall down. I give it my class, law school class. I was teaching law school, and I told them, you know, I missed the class last week, and I had missed the class. And I said, what happened was I was driving to school, and I saw a lady over there on the sidewalk trip and fall. So I got up and got out of the car and went over there and said to her, gee, I'm sorry. You seem to have turned your ankle. And then I said, well, for $50, I'll take you to emergency. Otherwise, I'm going to go to class. And I'm straight face. You know. I can see the students out there. And I said, well, what are you complaining about? I've been teaching economics. And after all, you know, if the price is better, the lower price, I'll do the more valuable thing, because I was missing a class. And the class is worth something to you. Maybe worth $1,000, I don't know. But here I was, give up a class to help this lady. I don't go around giving people gifts. On the way to school, I see somebody poor or somebody. I don't go around stopping. So what was wrong with that? Well, the law school students, they can't take a joke. Their life is serious. But I raised the question, why would somebody do what I did? Why would I stop and help her, knowing it was going to cost you fellows a lot more? It's going to do more damage to society at large than helping her get home. But I did it. Okay, you lawyers, tell me why I did it. Tell me what's good about that. Couldn't get an answer. They went through all this garb of gobbledygook and stuff. And I said, but it's true. We do things like that. We impose upon ourselves and certain people emergency help to somebody else. Why? What makes us do that? Economics can explain that. I said, suppose we didn't have that custom. Suppose we weren't taught to be good Samaritans. What would life be like? And they began to see the point. I said, well, that's fine. But why do we help ourselves rather than somebody else? Why would it turn out that your clan helps the clan more than it helps some stranger? Give me an answer for that. Culture. I said, fine. Why would I help a person rather than a dog? After all, they're living out. They got very similar genetic structures. Why would I help a person rather than a dog? Well, I got to see genes. The more common your genes are, the more you'll treat them as a group. that was a great couple of days lecture for class. It's a good problem to give the students, particularly when you give them the economic explanation that, look, if we didn't do that, the Klan would suffer a greater loss. And we do live as a group. We're not individuals. So while we talk individualistic, fundamentally economics talks about groups, the genetic group. And that made these students, I think, happier. They thought, oh, economics is just not narrow selfishness. It's Klan selfishness.
How is it enforced? I can see how it's in society's interest or the Klan's interest to have you stop and help her.
When I told the students what I'd done the first time, they got very angry at me. I didn't like that. That's how they enforce it. They found out I'd done that, and they ostracized me. And I said, if you've ever been ostracized, you don't know what punishment is. Sometimes you're going to get ostracized. You'll know it. That's a very severe punishment. When I started economics in the 30s, the literature, it was terrible. It was mostly doctrinaire. What should the world, how should you behave? What's a good world? You know, no facts. They would write, it's disgraceful when I look back, and just terrible, just junk. And there's nothing testable, nothing could be right or wrong empirically. And so after the war, when economics really changed from a proselytizing, preaching discipline to a factual one like science, you have to pay attention to the facts. And so you do.
Do you reject the usefulness of sort of an a priori type of reasoning?
No, the trouble is you can have an infinite number of a priori starting points. And how do you decide which one is worthwhile? The one that will help you get along in life better, make fewer erroneous predictions about what's going to happen. So the test is, how well will this glasses you're wearing help you see what's going to happen in the world when you do certain things? And it's the best I know of.
So you and Milton Friedman then would lock arms and march forward together as strict positivists?
So would Samuelson, so would all of them. I think every economist after the war has the same point of view. You can differ about whether the government should do more or whether I should take more pity on you or give more charity. That's nothing to do with economics. It's just you got guys who are very powerful in their ability to convey ideas, and Milton was very powerful in this respect, and Paul in that respect.
Some people claim that there is a conflict between property rights and human rights.
Yeah, you're waiting for me. You're waiting for that one, weren't you? Property rights are what enables human rights to be revealed, to be exercised, to have the rights. You can have rights but can't exercise them. What the hell do they mean? Property right is a human right. That's all. It's the right of somebody to use certain resources, and not you but me.
But are there often conflicts between these two? I hesitate to say types of right, but let's talk about the right to vote, which most people wouldn't think of as being a property right, call a human right. And
I don't want to call it a human right either. Call it a political right.
Political right. Yeah. Okay. So both of these you would call human rights.
Yep.
All right. So the right to vote and the right to own land would both be human rights. Yeah. One we would typically call a property right. The other one we would call, say, a political right. So would it be correct to say there are often conflicts between property rights and political rights?
Let me say no. There's no conflict. Just elements. I don't see why there'd be any conflict.
Most of us would agree that I have some right to lobby regulators. And let's suppose you have a piece of land, and it's a nice looking piece of land.
Why did you say to lobby?
To talk to me. Well, but you're not the regulator. You have property rights and a piece of land. Let's suppose.
Well,
all right.
And I own this hotel.
All right. And someone who's a stranger to both of us happens to be a local politician. And I say, it'd be nice if this hotel lowered the prices for me. Or just let me use the parking lot to park my cars in.
Yeah. All right. Come and ask me, and I might say yes, and I might say no.
But instead of asking you, or instead of offering you money, I might go to the politician.
You would.
All right. Yeah. So in that sense, is there a conflict between your property rights and my political rights?
No. I don't see any conflict. You have the right to go to talk to anybody you want to talk to. persuade him to commit suicide, to persuade him to marry your daughter, persuade him to give you money, persuade him to vote, which is, you know, says persuade, influence the king. Nothing to do with property rights. Now, if you tell him you want to persuade him to take away my property rights, you got a right to do that. After all, the property rights are what the rest of society will enforce for me. If the rest of society says we're not going to enforce rights anymore, okay, don't have them, they're gone.
Yeah. So then are the only conflicts the conflicts between human beings because we live in a world of scarcity?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's the word that, you know, when you talk about the government taxing, taking this wealth away from me, it's not the government, it's you and you and you. You're voting to tell that government, the military leader, to go and take money from Al, should I give it to you? And it's not the government, it's you that are out there persuading. We don't put it that way. That's very, that would be very antisocial. It would destroy our society. No, it's you guys that are the competitors in this world. And but after all, without you, I'd be even worse off. So, you know, they're like me. They want more too. So I don't complain.
Well, do markets enhance freedom?
Do markets enhance freedom? No, that's a dumb question. Well, you can't answer why I say it's a dumb question, even though it's really an answer. No, it's part of the right, the ability to go to a market and buy and sell is part of freedom. You know, put it that way. You know, if you've got, you know, the word freedom is a nasty word, but if I were to define it, if you assign. If all resources have private property and rights attached to them, and they're full, you've got a free society.
Okay.
I don't get excited about the use of the word freedom. I get more excited about the institutions under which you live. And if you want to call it more free, you're willing to go ahead and do so.
So you would define freedom in terms of the entire social institution in which I live?
Well, I would define freedom if you've got... It's a function of private property. If you've got private, if you're in a society of private property, the more widespread our private property rights among the population, the freer that society is. I wouldn't want to have property rights only me, the rest of you don't have those rights. The more widespread are these private property rights, the freer that the people are in that society. That's my definition. If you don't like it, go to have your own. And we might argue about which is the better, but I don't know how I would decide which is the better of those two.
Let me toss another quote out from you. It says, authority cannot establish what people will believe in, believe is true. The individual must do that.
I never know when I got the truth. All I know is I've got certain beliefs, and so far they've not got me in any more trouble than I can think of. I'm sorry. They have got me in the less trouble than I think I would have gotten into had I believed something else. I have no other criterion for truth.
You mentioned here Rand, and I was reminded of a story which you told me once, and I'd like you to recount it for me again. It's commonplace now in financial economics to do what are called event studies, in which people try to understand either the causes or consequences of events by studying their effect on stock market prices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you claimed to me once that you were the inventor of the event study.
I claim it. I can't prove it, of course, because the document was a secret document, and I asked to have it, asked to find it. They can't find it, they say. So I can't verify it. I may be lying through my teeth, but I tell you I'm not. And I can get some friends who are still alive who will tell you, yeah, he did do that. Reuben Kessler, he's dead. Maybe Bill Meckler, he's dead. They're all dead. It was, I think, November of 19... When was the H-bomb exploded? February 13th of some year. Let's say 52, I don't know, some year. Anyway, we were working, knew about the bomb and stuff, knew they were developing this H-bomb. But we want to know, the economists want to know, what's in it? What's the fissile material? Well, there's thorium, thallium, beryllium, I don't know, something else what it was. And we'd ask Herman Kahn, and he said, can't tell you. Herman always came over to the economics department, a good friend, and I don't know what it was. It got in, and I said, I'll find out. And what area, maybe, I don't know. So I went down to the Rand Library and had him get for me the U.S. government's Department of Commerce yearbook, which has items on every industry by product. So I went through, looked up thorium, who makes it, looked up beryllium, who makes it, looked them all up. It took me about 10 minutes to do it and got them. There were about five companies, five of these things. And then I called Dean Witter, where I was also had a stock account, and called a fellow and said, they had the names of the companies also making it. They said, look up for me the price of the following companies. I said, I want to get that tomorrow from you if I can come down and get it. He said, yeah, I'll get it for you. I went down there. And here were these four or five stocks going like this. And then about, I think it was September, this was now around October. I didn't get the exact. One of them started to go like that from 2 to around, oh, I said around 10. The rest were going like this. So I thought, well, it's interesting. So I put out a, whether it was called a document or a memorandum or a research memorandum, they're all different categories of security. Mine must have been the one that was pretty high because I can't find it now. I wrote it up and distributed it around the social science group the next day. I got a phone call from the head of RAND, Colbone, calling me in. Nice guy, I knew him well. You know, he said, Army, he said, we gotta suppress this. We gotta put this away. We don't like this. I said, yes, sir. And he smiled. I said, we'll do it, sir. He grinned and I grinned. And I took it and put it away. And that was the first event study. Anyway, it made my reputation among a lot of the engineers that ran. That was fun.
Some people have said that that golf contains the essence of life.
Yeah,
does it also contain the essence of economics?
I don't know. I can make up a story that does and try to justify it, but it does. I don't know whether, but it does. The disappointments come quick. And, you know, it's you against the world. It's you against the world, you know, and nothing you can do about it. You got yourself in that trouble. Get yourself out of it. And you can't blame anybody else. You just did it yourself. And damn it, you're not as good as somebody else. You're just not as good as that guy. God, damn it, why can't I do that? I just can't do it. But I can beat that guy. So you go through life, and it's just like a golf round, you know, as it is. It's a nice story, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it's satisfying when you have a bad day. You say, well, I've experienced another life. You know. And there's so much to do to these little chance events that seem ridiculous to influence the outcome so strongly. And you can see why the Greek gods believed, why the Greeks believed in gods. Things happen out there that just couldn't happen unless somebody deliberately pushed that ball over. You know, it cuts down this line and suddenly turns that way. You do it again and it goes straight each time it turned. You know, pushed it. I'd be a believer in the Greek gods, sure as hell if I were a Greek.